Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. The Mosquito Fire is the latest wildfire in Northern California and currently sits at over 46,000 acres burned, with just 10% containment as of Sunday evening. The fire has forced over 11,000 residents to evacuate in the Sierra Foothill communities of Forest Hill and Todd Valley in Placer County, as well as Georgetown, Bottle Hill, and Volcanoville in El Dorado County. Nearly 6,000 homes and structures remain threatened, and close to 2,400 firefighters and personnel are working day and night. Governor Gavin Newsom declared a state of emergency. The hope is, with additional federal resources, CAL FIRE and assisting agencies can get a hold of the wildfire, which continues to grow. Joining us is Chris Vestal, Battalion Chief for Sacramento Metropolitan Fire District. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Vicky. How are you?
Doing good. Thank you. Thanks for joining us. I know it's been a busy weekend. What is the latest update you can share on the Mosquito Fire?
Well, at this point, we're at 46,500 acres, and it's continuing to grow. And it's growing primarily in two different areas. Some of the names may not be familiar to everybody, so I'll try and walk you through them. There is Buckeye Point, which would be very common to some people knowing the confluence of the north and middle fork of the American River. And then it's also progressing north and northeast past the community of Forest Hill in areas of Iowa Hill and the former gold rush town of Deadwood, which is some neat history there. It was a town where Leland Stanford Jr. actually founded his gold mining operation and found his fortune. But that former town, it's also part of the Western States Trail.
Yeah, there's a lot of history in that portion of the American River Canyon. The Mosquito Fire had zero containment until Sunday. What changed?
Well, this terrain is extremely difficult to build containment line on, so we can talk through that a little bit. Containment line isn't simply running a single bulldozer path through and having a couple firefighters stand there with hoses ready to attack the oncoming fire. Containment line means that that line can hold itself with an oncoming fire with minimal fire suppression efforts. So it has to be extremely wide. It also has to be down to mineral soil, so no vegetation or only large diameter vegetation that's limbed up. But these canyons and the steep terrain means that our bulldozers can't just do a straight line through it. And then the hand crews have to do improvement on either side of that. So removing some of the brush that bulldozers can't just knock over, that has to be removed from the area. And it's very tedious in this territory. We also have to build that line far away from the fire, or indirect, as we call it. So instead of building that line right on the fire perimeter, it has to be moved far out where our personnel, as well as our heavy equipment, can actually access.
Yeah, and especially when talking about hand crews, that is grueling work. And we're going to have relatively cooler temperatures this week. But what impact last week did the historic heat wave have on the wildfire, as well as the physical toll on fire crews?
Well, the weather is always a major factor. It oftentimes can drive wildfires. And we had historic heat here in Sacramento Valley and the Northern California region. We saw a few other fires as well in the North State that grew really fast. And we had a lot of resources that were assigned to those. When this fire started on September 6th, it was late in the afternoon. It was one of those over 105, 110 degree days. And it took a lot of resources for that initial attack. We then started getting more resources through the California Master Mutual Aid System. It's one of the most beneficial things that California has. We can get any number of resources, any type of resources at any time from any agency really, really quickly through the ordering process. However, we also had firefighters who were coming from some of those other incidents. They were already fatigued, working in extreme heat. So that's one of the things that fire managers look at. How fresh are our people? How long can they work? Are they being effective at doing their job in those assignments that we give them?
You're talking about steep, rugged terrain in the American River Canyon. And over the weekend, the incident's fire behavior analyst cautioned that while this isn't necessarily a weather show, it's a fuels show. I imagine there's a lot of low moisture in that area.
These fuels that we're currently fighting this fire in are historically and critically dry. Even today, with the incoming moisture that we've had settle in the last few days in the inversion layer, our fuel moisture, our relative humidity in the northeast portion of the fire was at 31% at 6 a.m. So for reference, 31% would be dry almost any day of the year, but to have that at 6 a.m. is really, really concerning. When we're making our plans on what we're going to do, our strategic objectives on building containment line or attacking the fire, we look at all those factors. So number one, we look at the fire itself. What's it doing? We look at the fuel that it's moving into. Is it heavy timber? Is it manzanita? And then we look at the recent fuel moistures in the area. We look at past fire history, and we look at the other types of natural breaks that we can have. The weather that we've had has been somewhat tropical. So we've had some additional moisture the last couple of days, but that doesn't mean that that has affected those critically dry and historically low fuel moistures.
I want to get to air quality and smoke as well as the fire producing pyrocumulus clouds. I mean, SF Gate reported it went 40,000 feet into the atmosphere. What impact does this have on the air response?
Well, when you see the pyrocumulus cloud, we actually have an atmosphere which is able to have that cloud lift up, and that smoke is not necessarily hovering to ground level. So it's not creating the inversion layer, which we saw the last several days. But those pyrocumulus clouds do present some challenges for us. As you mentioned, they can create their own weather systems. But the other thing that people need to understand about smoke is that it's particulate matter. We talked about it from an air quality standpoint. But that particulate matter that's being lifted high into the atmosphere, high into the sky, that looks really, really impressive, is also a solid matter. It's being lifted by heat and convection currents, which are moving up. When that gets too heavy to support itself because there's not enough heat, or there's just so much weight to that particulate matter that the heat can't support it anymore, that can then crash down. Those downdrafts can then push the fire out in nearly every direction. And then we start talking about the sporadic fire growth and behavior. And that becomes really dangerous for us.
When talking about the fire growth at the onset of the mosquito fire last week, a CAL FIRE battalion chief said it made about a 5,000 acre run in a matter of 2 to 3 hours. That's like 27 acres a minute. I mean, that's difficult to comprehend. Can you explain how that's possible?
Well, that's where we talk about these deep canyons. They're not just hard for our personnel to work on or even our heavy machinery, but it really can drive the fire as well. There's a lot of those steep canyons, as we've talked about already, but there's also features within those that add to the fire growth. Those valleys, and when you're talking about in the Sierras, think about Lake Tahoe, which is sitting at 5,000 or 6,000 feet, and then Sacramento, which is only sitting at, you know, a couple dozen feet. This fire is running uphill, and those winds that we have coming from predominantly the south and southwest can align and push that fire towards the east, but that's pushing it uphill. Heat rises. So as those align with that, that heat does exactly what it wants to do, and the fire goes exactly uphill like heat always has, as we've always been taught.
You know, this area has been prone to wildfires in the past. I mean, you just described the terrain and the conditions. How close is the mosquito fire in the footprints of and the burn scars of the King Fire in 2014 and the smaller American Fire in 2019?
Well, right now, the American Fire is actually providing some very good border for us on the eastern side of the fire. In fact, I was out in that area yesterday, and it's actually bumping up against it on some of those eastern portions of the fire. And we will work in general to improve lines next to prior burn scars because there has been a reduction in fuel. And that's another advantage is the prior containment lines that were built for the American and the King Fire allow us to do minimal work to improve lines rather than having to put in a lot of effort to build completely new lines. And the other thing with fire history, typically when we see a fire start in an area where there was a fire, whether it was a dozen or decades ago, or even 100 years ago, they oftentimes follow the same path. So we can use that past fire history as sort of a predictive indicator of what might happen with a new fire.
So predictability and also a buffer.
Absolutely. So we learn from the past, and then we also use those strategic advantages that were put in place for that prior fire and use them to our advantages now. We see what might have worked back then, or what didn't work, and we can implement those decisions and those objectives into our new firefight.
Given that last week Governor Newsom declared a state of emergency for this wildfire that opens up federal resources, what does that actually do? How does that help firefighters accomplish their job at containing and suppressing this wildfire?
Well, as I stated earlier, in California, we get our resources when we request them. When they're available and the order is in, we can get that, whether that's for fire engines, aircraft, fire managers, whatever it is. We put the order in and we get it. What then has to happen afterwards is, of course, it has to be paid for. And it's no secret that fighting fires is expensive. There's a lot of different agencies that are involved. In California, we often see CAL FIRE. We'll see the United States Forest Service. Then we'll see Cal OES, which acts as really the liaison or the agency rep for all the local governments that participate. All of those disaster declarations provide the funding that ultimately comes in behind and remedies the cost apportionment for the different parts of the fire and all the different agencies that respond to it.
Given that there's been some visual confirmation of a property that has either been damaged or destroyed, do you have any idea from a quantitative standpoint how many homes and structures have been damaged or destroyed?
We do know that there has been several properties that have been damaged and destroyed. Our damage inspection process is ongoing. That actually started a few days ago, but it's a very involved process. It's not just a matter of seeing a property and saying, yep, that one's destroyed. It actually gets entered into a database. It gets recorded. It gets an estimate of how much damage may have occurred or if it's considered to be destroyed. All of that has to go through a process. It has to be validated and verified. And then we want to provide that information as soon as possible to those who are affected by it. And the real reason we do that is so that they can then start their process on with recovery and rebuilding and making their decisions to move forward.
Evacuation orders and warnings expanded this weekend in Placer County. What message do you have for those waiting to return home safely in the last, 20 seconds or so that we have?
The biggest thing people need to understand about evacuation orders and warnings is that our incident commanders will not implement those unless we believe that there is a strong likelihood of life safety compromise. When we put those in, we recognize the inconvenience that it is for the community, the economic hardship that it can place. So I think everybody needs to understand that when those are put in, they are serious. It's time to leave immediately when you get an evacuation order. And if you're in a warning area, it's time to prepare so that when the evacuation order comes in, you leave immediately.
And that is Battalion Chief Chris Vestal with the Sacramento Metropolitan Fire District. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. We're back in just a few moments.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. For millennia, animals, both wild and domestic, have provided humans a seemingly endless number of benefits, from food to livelihood, education, transportation, and even emotional support. But this relationship also opens us up to zoonotic diseases, which can spill over from animals to humans. According to the CDC, 75% of new or emerging infectious diseases come from animals, the most notable example being COVID-19, although officially the origin hasn't been confirmed. confirmed, scientists strongly believe the virus originated and evolved from an animal before jumping over to humans. Although zoonotic diseases are known and very common, what's been difficult over the years is assessing the likelihood of spilling over to humans and ultimately the risk of becoming a pandemic. That's now about to change. Using artificial intelligence, researchers at UC Davis have created a new tool to better understand these emerging viruses and prioritize which ones pose the greatest risk of jumping from animals to us, with the goal of better preparing for future pandemics. Joining us now to tell us more about this innovative tool is Dr. Pranav Pandit, a veterinary epidemiologist at UC Davis and lead researcher on the project. Dr. Pandit, welcome to Insight.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So your research focuses on ecology of emerging infectious diseases. That's basically how organisms relate and affect one another. I would imagine that leads to like endless possibilities with pretty exciting finds.
Yeah. I mean, it's an interesting field, especially to me personally. I'm really excited to working on emerging infectious diseases. And what we really do is like try to understand how these zoonotic diseases actually are transmitted between animal population, within animal populations, and really try to understand the factors that kind of lead to eventually the transmission to human beings. And it might be due to climate change or any other large-scale changes that we do in the nature that might help those pathogens to spill over into humans. So just trying to understand those factors and understanding the mechanisms behind that is what the research is, what we do.
As a veterinary epidemiologist, I mean, obviously we know that COVID-19 isn't the only coronavirus. What has made COVID-19 and its subvariants similar and at the same time very different from other coronaviruses that you've studied?
Right. I think in itself, human coronaviruses are very different from each other. So there are about 7 human coronaviruses that we know, at least, including SARS-CoV-2, the COVID-19 virus. Within those, even like all those viruses are different. Like, I guess 4 of them, they cause not such a severe disease. They are low pathogenic and they generally just tend to be endemic in human populations. While 3 others, like SARS-CoV-2, the SARS, the first SARS virus, and MERS, they really cause like acute diseases, like severe diseases in humans. So even within humans, they are very different. And in general, if you look at the virus family for coronaviruses, which is called as coronaviridae, it's a really highly diverse virus family. It does have 5 genera within that, and they tend to infect all different kinds of animals, including birds. There are very well-studied domestic animal diseases, including diseases of poultry, dogs, cats, pigs, and they also infect quite a lot of wild birds, including some species and some interesting even marine mammals. Mm. So it's a quite a diverse group of viruses. But the coronaviruses that we are kind of studying are actually novel coronaviruses. These are the coronaviruses that have been recently discovered in wildlife. And we are trying to understand what risk they pose to human beings. Can they even infect wide variety of animal species? Or if they can infect wide variety of animal species, can they infect human beings? So that's the research that we are doing.
Given that zoonotic diseases, I mean, the CDC believes like 75% are zoonotic diseases. So if we know that and there's an established history with viruses spilling over from animals to humans, why is the risk and the evolutionary history very limited?
Right. I wouldn't say the knowledge about human coronaviruses or in general coronaviruses is limited, but there is so much to explore and so much to understand. Like even within the known human coronaviruses, we do know for some of them the possible reservoir hosts, but we still don't know what exact mechanisms caused them to eventually spill over into humans, what really happened during those times. So that's still there for us to explore and understand, including things like what were some of the intermediate hosts, were there any intermediate hosts that helped amplify those viruses and then eventually helped transmission into human beings. So
Well, you envisioned and you created a tool, you and your colleagues, in creating essentially a system which prioritizes new and known viruses for their risk of passing over between animals and humans. Help us visualize how this works.
Absolutely. So what we do, what we did was basically, since the aim was to understand the risk that these novel viruses will pose to human beings, we actually looked at a well-recognized known zoonotic and non-zoonotic viruses. We eventually created a big database of those viruses and their known vertebrate hosts, like all the species, animal species that these viruses are known to infect, including human beings. And then we used a network approach, basically created a network of viruses that are interconnected with each other, just like let's say a social network for viruses that are sharing host between each other, and developed some artificial intelligence models, some machine learning models that help us predict the missing links within that network. And those missing links eventually help us quantify the zoonotic risk that they pose to human beings.
Where does artificial intelligence come into this in terms of assisting in understanding the risk of a zoonotic disease passing over into humans and also potentially causing a pandemic?
Right. I think in general, right now, artificial intelligence and machine learning models are it's an exciting time for researchers like me. It's going to play a really important role in understanding the pandemic risk that novel viruses or very well-known viruses pose to human beings, especially because the field itself has become really data-driven. We are generating a lot of data around surveillance in wildlife, surveillance in domestic animals, surveillance in humans, and just the movement of animals, movement of people, climate change, all these things are really rich in data. We're just collecting a lot of data. And that's where like some of these machine learning models do really well in kind of identifying the mechanisms, the drivers behind a specific viruses distribution and all those things. So it's really exciting time for researchers like us who use machine learning. Yeah.
If you had this tool before 2020, how would it have been useful for COVID-19?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think it would have been really useful, at least what we have been able to, during our study, what we have been able to understand is that the model was actually even really good in identifying or having a high prioritization score for viruses that were already, that we know are zoonotic in nature. So I'm just imagining that the model would have also predicted to have higher prioritization score for a virus, something like COVID-19. Mm. Yeah.
I'm curious about the monkeypox outbreak, although not classified as a pandemic, but this is a zoonotic virus that resembles smallpox. It was first discovered in 1970, so more than 50 years ago, according to the World Health Organization. Would this tool have been useful in curbing the current spread that we're experiencing?
Right. Probably not this specific tool, because this specific tool, we already know that monkeypox is zoonotic in nature. Mm-hmm. This tool tries to understand whether a disease that we don't know yet whether it will be a zoonotic disease or not will be zoonotic in nature. Although there are some models that do try to identify, machine learning models that do try to identify where and when some of these diseases might emerge. And that would have been really useful to kind of implement those and understand the risk monkeypox poses for a pandemic threat.
What do zoonotic diseases like coronaviruses, what makes them, I guess, arguably more savvy in actually spreading and creating a pandemic?
Right. I think the early research that our group is doing is able to identify that especially viruses that do tend to infect wide variety of species. Let's say a virus is infecting bats as well as is able to infect rodents or other a large number of mammal species. They tend to eventually become zoonotic. They tend to have higher likelihood of becoming zoonotic in the future. So I think some of those things kind of prep those viruses really well. Along with that, having an opportunity, an ecological or epidemiological opportunity to eventually get exposed to human beings and then have an ability to infect people is what all drives in the emergence of novel viruses.
Yeah, and the timeliness as well, because your models use data from more than 500 new viruses that were discovered in just a span of a decade, 2009 to 2019. What can you tell us about these viruses?
Right. So actually, the project identified more than 900 novel viruses.
Also close to double that number.
Yeah, but just the model was able to develop significant predictions for about 531 novel viruses out of those. And all those viruses have been detected all across the world, in Latin America, in Africa, in Southeast Asia, and in wildlife species that are in close association with human beings. So in agriculture fields, in bat caves that are frequently used by human beings, or in market value chains where animals are sold and bought and all those things. So these wild animals are already in very close association with human beings. And that's where we have found all these viruses.
I'm curious with COVID-19, because it is a zoonotic disease, but in the last, two plus years, there's also transmission back into the animal population, like deer and rodents, I believe even, domestic animals like cats. What does that tell us, especially with the risk of a new variant emerging?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, that's where we have to again start doing surveillance in animals. And just the circulation of COVID back into, like, circulation of COVID-19 in these animal populations increases the chances of emergence of a new variant, because then the virus gets an opportunity to multiply and evolve into something new that can again spill back into humans, for which we probably might not have enough immunity. So all those things really matter a lot. So kind of for a long-term prevention and control of COVID-19, we really need to know how the virus is also circulating in multiple animal species and in wildlife.
Yeah, so essentially this back and forth between humans and animals creates more opportunities for this virus to evolve into more subvariants.
Absolutely, yeah.
You really just briefly touched upon this at the beginning of our conversation, but I want to dive into it. How does climate change and just increased environmental degradation complicate and perhaps increase the need for this type of research?
Yeah, I mean, climate change, like it's we know that it's going to affect the species distribution, including distribution of some of the vectors that transmit some of these viruses. And that's going to change a lot of background populations of these species that harbor some of these viruses. And some of these species might increase human contacts due to pressures that they are feeling due to climate change. And same with large-scale landscape changes that we are doing, either through deforestation or just through landscape changes that we can quickly do, let's say road building, building of dams. All these things kind of displace large-scale populations and might increase human contact with those wild species. And again, as I said earlier, it might increase our chances to share some of those viruses with them, and those viruses might get an opportunity to spill into humans. So as climate change happens, we're going to see more and more possible emergence of novel viruses, novel pathogens coming across. And some of these models will be super useful to understand the early risks or early signals into that.
Yeah, another system you're looking at is ranking another family of viruses. I mean, this family includes viruses like measles and mumps, respiratory tract infections. Why should these viruses be a concern? Because they're labeled as high priorities when there's vaccines for measles and mumps.
Right, yeah. Even though there are vaccines for measles and mumps, there are other viruses from the same family, like Paramyxoviridae, that are emerging in nature, like Nipah viruses, Hendra viruses. These are viruses that come from bats, and many other bat paramyxoviruses might eventually emerge again, similar to COVID-19. So even though we have vaccines for some of the viruses, there is a lot of I would say there is a lot of other viruses that mm-hmm. we need to prioritize and increase our surveillance for yeah. from this virus.
That are highly contagious as well.
Yes, yeah.
You know, getting to the crux of understanding how COVID-19 emerged is pretty paramount in preventing future zoonotic outbreaks from becoming pandemics. But the origin has been the subject of controversy, political finger pointing, misinformation, and you know, that couldn't be underscored enough. But given that you're a researcher, what evidence do you have that strongly suggests that the virus spilled over from animals to humans in Wuhan?
Right. I think there are a couple of very interesting recent papers that came out right now, especially led by Dr. Anderson and his colleagues. And they shed a great light on the possible events that might have occurred in the very, very early days in the Huanan market in Wuhan in China. What they found is that the very early cases were within people or vendors that were selling wildlife. Within the market, and they also identify that there might be at least two different zoonotic spillovers that happened within the market, the Huanan market. Even though like the exact events are still pretty much clouded, but those are pretty strong indications that some of the emergence events really happened within the market in Wuhan City.
Dr. Pranav Pandit is a veterinary epidemiologist at UC Davis. Thank you so much for the time.
Thank you for having me.
And for your research.
Yeah.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. David Watts Barton is a familiar name to CAP Radio and Sacramento journalism. The author and singer-songwriter was the interim host of Insight between Jeffrey Callison and Beth Rujak. David has since moved away from a long career as a journalist in Sacramento across the ocean to Berlin. But David made a stop back to the capital city and to CAP Radio to discuss his latest album. I love that, you know, you were first introduced to Insight because as a musician, you performed on Insight.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. I was actually brought on with Jackson Griffith, who was at a newspaper, and I was at the Bee. And I think I was at the Bee, or maybe I was at Sacramento Press. But they wanted journalists who were songwriters, of which there are a number, because we're music critics who, you know, shoulda, coulda, woulda. So I'm living that dream now. I put out one record then, and I finally recorded this one of the songs that I played that day when I was here. So it's on the new album. And so they liked how I sounded on the air, and so they invited me to come back and try out to be a host. It was it was one of those magical, unexpected career path things, of which my life has had quite a few in the last 10 years.
Yeah, quite serendipitous. Yeah. Given that you lived in Sacramento for most of your life, you are now no longer in Sacramento or California or even the United States. You're overseas. You're in Berlin.
Yeah.
Tell us about the move.
Yeah, it was quite something. I mean, I left Sacramento before I was interim host. And I came back just to do that. I moved to New York. So I lived in New York for about 5 years, did a one-man show in New York, wrote and performed a one-man show, and played some music and did some journalism, worked for Bloomberg. And then I came back to Sacramento to record this album. Oh, then I traveled for about 5 years, and I just bounced between here and Japan and Europe, Berlin. I always loved Berlin. Italy, I love. And I I actually wrote a book about Japan, but that's another story. That came out last year. And I found myself at the end of that, I came back here to record this album, Pilgrim, and I had a gig on a Saturday night, and Wednesday the governor locked down the state. So I didn't have anywhere to live, and my show was canceled, and I couldn't go into the studio. So I ended up living in a friend's attic on North C Street in a warehouse for about 4 months, right down the street from where all the other homeless people are. And I ended up finishing another book and wrote some more songs and had a great time back in Sacramento and rode the bike trail every day. And at the end of about 6 months, my friend said, well, what's your plan? Which my friends often ask me. And I said, I'm going to move to Berlin. It just sort of popped in my head. And so 10 days later, I was in Berlin. And I applied for an artist visa because they have a program where you can, if you're an artist, you can get a 3-year visa. So now I'm in the middle of a 3-year visa, and next year I'm going to extend it because I love Berlin.
Your album is titled Pilgrim. Yeah. I want to just talk very quickly about the inspiration for the album cover.
The album cover is just a photo I took on my first day on El Camino de Santiago in Spain. And I was looking back because I wanted to call the album Pilgrim because I conceived it on El Camino. The songs, a lot of the songs are old. One of the songs I played when I was here that first time on Insight. But I wanted to, because I am a pilgrim, I mean, I'm constantly on the move and traveling around and learning things and meeting new people. And so I wanted to call it Pilgrim. And I actually, one day on the Camino, I just walked and I sang every song that I had in a row in the order that I wanted to do them, which of course isn't what it ended up being. But I ended up finishing a couple songs on the Camino. The Gift Must Move is very much about the Camino. And that's the impetus. And then I came back, and that's why I came back to Sacramento to record it, because I have a lot of friends here. And Rick Lauder and I from Mumbo Gumbo recorded the album in his home studio. And it finally happened 3 years later, but here it is.
Well, let's listen to your first song that you sent over. It's called Ring.
Ring. You ring so true. Of course you do. And I for you. Ring the morning bell. I know so well. And any fool can tell.
And say love inspired this song.
Yeah, love inspired and word inspired too, yeah. Because that word ring, I actually wrote that a long time ago and it was just an instrumental. It's super simple, but it just has a certain feel to it. And then the word ring has like, I will ring for you. It's like, I'll call you. And then I ring for you like in my heart. And it's like ring. It's just a whole feeling, you know, but sure, love.
But we're going to turn the corner a little bit with your next song. So mm-hmm. Let's listen to Gin.
Felt so ordinary, didn't sparkle, didn't shine, didn't think I'd ever win. And then I discovered gin. Now whiskey will make you foolproof. And vodka will make you thin. But if you want the whole truth, you gotta have action.
All right, this one has some attitude to it. You know, yeah. I'm envisioning like a dark dive bar or blues club and maybe a little bit of heartache too.
Yeah, definitely.
One end of the spectrum to the other.
Yeah, a little addiction. Yeah, always good for a song. Yeah, it's funny because while we were recording the album, every time we'd finish one, Rick would say, well, there's another song that doesn't fit on the album, you know, because I grew up on the Beatles. So I grew up, and David Bowie and stuff. It's like people who just try lots of different things. So as you can hear through the album, I mean, the next song is a full band, kind of a little bit more of a country kind of feel. The next song is much more like Ring. It's just me, and then with a lot of extra added guitars, but very kind of a dark song, a sad song. So it kind of moves around a lot.
You have a lot of other creative juices that you tap into. You briefly touched upon it when we first started chatting. You had a book published last year, Japan, From Anime to Zen, A Quick Take on Culture, Art, History, Food, and More. It's described as a pocket-sized book, paperback travel companion. Talk to us about it.
Yeah, it's something that I wrote over the years because I was working for a company in Japan and writing about Japanese culture. And I've spent a lot of time in Japan. And, you know, the culture is utterly unique. And so I would spend a lot of time just learning about that. And I would post these once a week for a while, and then it backed off a little bit. And after I'd done about 80 of them, I thought, this is a book. So I just took it all together, sort of put it into five different sections and came up with a title. And sent it to a couple of publishers, and the second publisher, who's in Berkeley, took it. And I've already made back my advance, and we've already sold a decent number of copies, and nobody can even go to Japan. Even now, you still can't go to Japan. But it's
That's not right.
A guidebook. It's not a guidebook. It's a book about different aspects of culture in these sort of quick takes, so you can learn about everything from wabi-sabi to what the difference between Zen Buddhism and Pure Land Buddhism to how do they process seaweed and tea, to who were the geisha really, who were the ninjas really, you know, these characters. So it's fun, and it's a good armchair kind of book, and you don't actually even have to go to Japan. If you're interested in Japan, it's a really good primer on Japan. If you're going, then you see things and you're kind of like, oh, okay, what's that? So, and it's on Kindle, it's on Amazon, so you can get a Kindle version and you don't have to carry a big book around with you.
Yeah. Before we let you go, David, I would be remiss if I didn't ask you how Burning Man was, which brings you to Sacramento before you go back home to Berlin. How was it?
It was fantastic. I mean, it's funny, they focus so much on the dust, but it's always dusty. You know, I come out of it with a little bit of a cough and bloodshot eyes, and it's just like, you know, but this was my 21st year. On my 20th year, which was 2019, I said, okay, I'm definitely done. This is it. But after 3 years off, and some of my friends were going, and there are people I haven't seen in 3 years, and the place itself is just magnificent. And for me, it's all about the people, just like El Camino, just like Berlin, just like Sacramento.
Well, David, thank you so much for returning to Cap Radio and to Insight.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That is David Watts Barton discussing his second album, Pilgrim. That's it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to join the conversation, you can email us at insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producers Nick Dobis and Victor Corral Martinez, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital producer is Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer is Chris Feltz. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. And I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.